Representative Parnell, chairing temporarily until Representative Donnelly arrives. I'll be departing shortly for another meeting with Finance. And with us are Representatives Ivan Ivan, Zawacki, and Betty Bruckman. And we'll initiate discussion on House Bills 348, 389, 468, and 489, with possible holdover of HB 423, the request of the sponsor at this particular time. We'd like to, for the sake of those who have been waiting and waiting for us to begin, welcome those of you that are in the audience and on teleconference, and Representative Ulmer, who is here to speak to House Bill 389. We'll move that up to the front. Appreciate the comments on the bill and any other people who would like to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 389 dealing with lead-acid batteries has been discussed by this committee previously. I just wanted to bring you up to date. Since we met last, I have participated in a sort of a working group via teleconference with a number of people, Portland, Seattle, Anchorage, here in Juneau, working with DEC, EPA, NC Machinery, a number of others who had concerns about the bills. We have come up with a proposed CS that everyone who has been participating in has now signed off on. Might also indicate staff of the Labor and Commerce Committee also participated. Very briefly, I'd like to tell you what the changes are in the CS that is in front of you. First of all, the bill now requires that a battery must be in reasonably sound and clean condition when it is delivered for a refund. In other words, a retailer or wholesaler can refuse to accept a battery that is in poor condition. And I think that makes sense, and that is consistent with how it's been done in other states. Secondly, the bill changes from 6 months to 1 month, the period of time in which the individual can come back with a used battery to get the refund. The business community was concerned that the 6 months might be too much of a paperwork problem for them, and if instead it was 1 month, that it was just going to make for a lot cleaner operation from their perspective. So that was also changed. We also added a section that allows the used battery to be dropped off at a drop-off center, a recycling center, and you can get a receipt for that and take that to the retailer so you don't have to pay the battery deposit. That was also suggested by folks from Anchorage, where there are drop-off centers right now, again, so that we minimize the number of batteries that are going to the retailers if there is an alternative, and then allow that credit to be used for purposes of the deposit. The bill also says that this requirement of the battery deposits and drop-off system doesn't apply in a community if there is no one in that community that is a transporter of batteries. And that was specifically requested by NC Machinery because of their concern that in some communities in Alaska where there wouldn't be a transporter, that by requiring this legislation to apply to those communities would really create a problem for the retailer. And they feel as though as long as it only applies in those communities where there is a transporter, that it will minimize the problem from the retailer's perspective. We spoke with EPA. Again, they did participate in these meetings. Apparently, all that is involved in the transporter getting the necessary license from EPA is basically a phone call and an ID number. And so it is not an unnecessary burden from the standpoint of the person who wishes to be a transporter. So I'm convinced that that is not going to be a significant problem. And the final change in the proposed CS is that there is a maximum weight of battery that needs to be recycled. In other words, this whole requirement of a deposit only applies for batteries weighing less than 25 kilograms. Again, this dealt with the concern that NC Machinery had for the very, very large batteries. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of pound batteries that they didn't want to have coming back to their retail operations. And they agreed that they recommended the 25 kilogram as a reasonable cutoff point that would still cover the vast majority of batteries bought and sold in Alaska and the vast majority of consumer batteries. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, those are the proposed changes in the CS that we all have agreed to in this little subcommittee process. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are we in teleconference? think we have.
Okay, are there questions for the current sponsor? Representative Taylor?
What happens to the batteries in a town without a trailer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, exactly the same thing that happens right now, which is if in that community there is a Napa Valley or a Napa battery or Sears distributor that has an internal recycling mechanism, they're going to continue to recycle their own batteries. If you're in a community where there isn't one of those, you will probably take it to your landfill. If your landfill takes it, some landfills will, some landfills won't. You might do something responsible, like try to seek out a recycler, which may or may not exist. I mean, basically, it's the status quo. Whatever you do with it now.
And the same applies, I guess, that the batteries are oversized. Whatever they're doing with them now is what we're going to do with them in the future.
This does not change that. Basically, this bill tries to deal with the vast majority of batteries in the vast majority of communities. From the standpoint of numbers of population and numbers of sales, it does not solve every battery problem in Alaska.
Any further discussion, questions? Is anybody here to testify on this legislation? Representative Omer, would you like to take a seat? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ernest Pauley. I'm representing Channel Corporations, which are a privately owned waste hauling and disposal facility. My clients are very strongly supportive of this particular bill, particularly in its committee substitute form, working out some of the practical problems with this type of thing in Alaska. Basically, we believe that it's good public policy to close the loop as quickly as possible on special wastes, and we would include automobile batteries as special wastes. The current situation is such that even though there is a local recycler of automotive batteries, lead-acid batteries, that will take these for free, and we discourage them bringing to our facility as strongly as possible, as a matter of fact, putting on financial charges. The fact of the matter is that on regular intervals in self-hauled waste that people bring in their pickups inside the cardboard box underneath the newspapers, here we have a lead-acid battery. That's an additional expense to us. We don't dare let them sit in the landfill for fear of increased contamination materials. We think financially it makes the best sense possible, given the alternatives, and certainly environmentally it does. And that concludes my comments.
Okay, questions for the witness? Thank you for your testimony today. I should announce for the record that House Bill 423 is going to be held over till Thursday, and that's February 27th, 92, just so I don't forget. Representative Taylor.
I guess it just means that the price of all batteries goes up by $5, and you get your $5 kickback as long as you bring one in that's undamaged, which means that retailer then has to store it, and he's responsible for getting recycled back into the system.
And Mr. Chairman, because of the proposed change in the CS that only requires that in communities where there's a transporter, it makes the system loop work a little more efficiently. And I would like to just publicly thank NC Machinery, all the recyclers in Anchorage and Seattle that joined us, the Department of Law, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and EPA that worked with us to promote the CS.
Representative Ivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question to the sponsor, first page, line 11, that a purchaser who doesn't, for the first time, doesn't bring any lead battery, they're charged no less than $5. I believe in the free enterprise system, of course, but the retailer can charge up to 10, or there's no limitation whatsoever, 10, 20, 30.
Mr. Chairman, it's what the free market will bear, I guess. I think setting $5 in this legislation is a way of saying that we think that that would be a good deposit. But if the particular retailer feels as though take $7 to help offset the cost of the retailer in terms of storing these until the transporter can pick them up, will allow him to do that. At some point, of course, he'll charge so much that the individual will take their business someplace else, and as I said, the free market system will kick in. But we're going to, you know, leave that up to the retailer.
Representative Taylor.
Well, what happens when the batteries are broken or leaking?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try to answer that, but there is someone here from the Department of Environmental Conservation, David Wigglesworth, who might be able to talk a little bit about the household hazardous waste and special waste problem. We're, by not requiring the retailer to take it, we're recognizing that if the retailer were forced to take a leaking battery, that it would pose a health hazard for his or her employees, and that we don't feel as though we ought to do that. What happens now, again, it's sort of status quo. They would take it to a recycler if a recycler exists in the community. They would take it to Channel Landfill or a local landfill that would allow them to take it. Or they might wait for DEC's hazardous household waste cleanup, which happens periodically. You may have noticed last weekend, I think there was one here in Juneau, and they take it to the DEC-sponsored hazardous waste drop-off. But, as I said, I would defer to David Wigglesworth if he has any comments about what
the difference is. Mr. Wigglesworth, just state
your name for the record. My name is David Wigglesworth with the Department of Environmental Conservation. I really don't have much to add other than, you know, the spring cleanup program does provide an option for those particular types of batteries. In some instances, the people that have existing battery recycling programs in place already in Alaska will accept some of those on a certain condition. And so there's some options that some retailers will want to take them. But for those that don't, I think it's good to provide them with that opportunity not to take them to relieve any liabilities they may have.
Further questions?
Well, I think this is all a wonderful exercise to go through, assuming that there is some real significant thing we need to be worried about there on the environment. I suppose there is. But I don't notice that there's any incentive in here for the human being who's got his hands on a lousy, leaky battery right now, and he knows how much it's going to cost him if he takes it downtown to try and find somebody to take it off his hands. What he does instead is he drives along the road, and he has his 14-year-old kid pitch it in the ditch, either next to your house or mine. That's status quo. That's real life. It never shows up in the landfill, because somebody in the landfill now earnings client or somebody's going to charge him for showing up out there with his battery, and somebody else is going to charge him someplace else if they show up with the battery. So the battery ends up in your backyard or mine or down the road from us in a ditch someplace. I have a hard time getting off the elevator anymore. We're recycling so busily around here. We're picking up pop cans. We're picking up one kind of paper. We're picking up another kind of paper. The hallways around here look like a garbage pit most of the time. I keep asking myself, are we doing any good, or is this a lot of make work to make ourselves feel like we're doing something good so we can spend a bunch more money? Wouldn't it cost us a lot less to do something else with this? Somebody says, well, you've got to look at the cost of landfills over time, how much they'll cost. I'm starting to ask questions like that, and people in the business are telling me, yeah, even if you look at the landfill costs themselves, it's still cheaper to put it in the landfill than it is to play all these games and ship it all the way to Seattle. Now, if status quo is okay, if you don't have a transporter in your town, then why would a town be so stupid as to go out and get somebody to want to be a transporter so they can start imposing this on themselves? I mean, especially a smaller village. I don't know why they'd want to do that. I don't know why they'd want to do it if they don't have to, if their batteries in that town are of a larger size. Apparently larger size batteries don't pollute. You can throw those any place you want. In other words, it's a nice idea, and it's probably important. I don't understand how it's going to work with that leaky battery and how anything in this bill is going to induce that fellow to bring his battery into us so that his comes into our system, too. Have you got an answer for me?
Were you going to respond to that?
Well, my comment on your comments are simply this. There is a problem with lead-acid batteries in Alaska. There's a problem with simply allowing them to go into landfills or in any place else that, as opposed to recycling. There is a good reason to recycle. They have value. you can reuse the lead, and then they're not out there doing bad things to water and to other things. Okay? So we want to get as many of them back as possible. We can't guarantee we're going to get all of them back. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to get any of them back. I mean, just because you can't go for 100% doesn't mean that you shouldn't reach for 90%. And that's what this bill reaches for. This bill reaches for 90%, or maybe it'll take us to 95%. I don't know. But it's a lot better than where we are today. It's better than doing nothing. And I will grant you that it doesn't reach every single last person who's irresponsible enough to toss it off the back end of their pickup truck. I don't know how to fix that problem. I mean, if you can tell me how to reach the pickup truck driver, fine, we can either amend this bill or pass another bill. But there's a lot to be said for reaching as many as possible. And this is why 19 other states have done this, because these are valuable commodities to recycle. People will pay money for lead acid batteries to recycle. That's why we're doing this. And because we want to get them out of the environment. So, you know, the effort that was made through the CS to work with private sector folks who are knowledgeable in the arena, I think has made it a better bill. But as I said, it still doesn't reach 100%.
Well, if these batteries are worth so much,
not so much,
to be recycled, and they always have been. Junk dealers have always taken batteries. In fact, used to pay for them. I had two stolen out of my truck in Wrangell alone, both of which were sold right to the junk dealer right down the street from my house after they were stolen out of my truck. So, yeah, I know that they are worth something. Always have been worth something. Now we're going to jack the price to the consumer by a minimum of $5. And if he brings one back in, I guess he gets the $5 returned. Why don't we make it like the old beer bottles used to be? Somebody finds the battery in the ditch, they bring it in, and they get the deposit on the battery. That'll get your area cleaned up if you're really worried about cleaning areas up. Put a $5 tag on every used battery out there.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't mind adding a bounty concept to this bill, which is what you're describing, giving people an additional incentive to go out and find some. I don't mind that idea. But this is one step in the right direction by giving the individual consumer, who has some responsibility, the individual consumer is being given an incentive to bring in the old battery. That's what we're doing here. We're not forcing him. We're not throwing him in jail for not doing it. We're simply giving him an incentive to do it. That's part of the solution. Another part of the solution is some sort of a cleanup effort of those who are out, the batteries that are out there already. So sort of the bounty concept, I mean, I don't mind adding that idea, but as I said, it's sort of one step at a time. There are a number of approaches that would help make it better. This is just one of several.
Well, DEC is here. Can he tell me what the problem is with a battery? Yeah, sure. I don't understand the problem. I want to know what the problem is.
Go ahead. The environmental problems associated with batteries, you have lead as well as acid, and lead itself in particular can be a problem not only to ground and surface waters if it leaches, if the battery's cracked or thrown away improperly into a landfill that's unlined and not able to handle that particular type of waste. You can have the potential for leaching into our ground and surface waters, not to mention potential public health hazard of people wandering in and about and maybe potentially being exposed to lead and or the acid by an improperly handled battery. So there's a lot of potential hazards of the batteries. And while I don't have the information as far as the pictures and other things like that we do have available from the department, there are a lot of batteries out there that are being mishandled. And this provides an opportunity for consumers of the batteries that are included in this bill to do the right thing and to make it easier for them to manage batteries in an appropriate fashion. Mm-hmm. So we're providing more options, and that's what our experience is with consumers, is that you got to make it really easy for them to do the right thing, and this is what this bill is trying to do.
Okay. Are there any more questions for this witness? Thanks for your testimony, Representative Breckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A quick comment would be that I, as a consumer, I think in the last 20 years have just turned over 3 car batteries, and each time it was at the gas station, replaced the old one with a new one. So I don't see it as costing a lot of consumers a lot of money, because again, you're trading an old for new in many cases, certainly not all. I see it as a means to clean up the environment, to protect our lands from the dangers of leaky batteries. We certainly have that problem in parts of Anchorage. And I would, Mr. Chairman, move that this bill should be passed out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay. Okay, there's no further people signed up to testify. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Holman. I'm going to go to Anchorage and House Bill 468. Mr. Rock, are you there?
What was the statement you made the other day?
I'm one of the most environmentally concerned people.
Play that back. Please put it on
there. He's got a carriage over there. I'll call him to describe it.
Damn.
Royce?
You're sick. So bad.
Donnelly and Juno, we're in Labor and Commerce meeting. We're joined by Representative Bruckman, Taylor, Zuwacki, and Ivan, and we're on House Bill 468. Did you want to give testimony?
I do.
Please proceed. Just identify yourself for the record, who you represent.
All right. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Royce Rock. I am speaking in support of House Bill 468. I'm employed as a business agent for Carpenters Local 1281. House Bill 468 applies to unfair trade practices in the construction industry for the willful failure to carry workman's compensation, unemployment compensation for employees. As the law stands today, it fails to afford broad enforcement, and it doesn't recognize the harm done to the construction industry by this form of unfair competition. Presently, only two parties can bring an action against an employer for violating the coverage requirements of the Workers' Compensation and Unemployment Compensation Act. Those parties are the workers and the state of Alaska. This has not proven to be an effective method of addressing the problem. Most workers do not sue their employers for illegally classifying them as subcontractors for three reasons. First, the workers are willingly participants in the scheme because they enjoy not having any deductions taken from their pay. Second, they don't complain because they fear losing their jobs. And third, the workers do not know that their employers are violating the law. The other party with standing to sue is the state of Alaska, but the state's enforcement mechanisms are too overburdened to address the problem. Illegal subcontracting is rampant. There are not enough inspectors to keep up with it, and the state with its budget deficit may not be in a position to hire additional inspectors. Thus, present enforcement mechanisms are not working. In addition to enforcement difficulties, the law today does not recognize the harm caused by this form of unfair competition to the construction industry. The law as it stands provides fines for the state and damages for employees, but it does not recognize the harm caused, for instance, to the contractor who loses bids to these illegal operators. Contractors who abide by the law and are being awarded by losing bids and profits. The law does not allow for damages that these law-abiding contractors suffer. By applying House Bill 468 to illegal subcontracting in the construction industry addresses many of the issues that I'm sure have been raised. First, it recognizes the harm done to the construction industry. Second, it allows the industry to clean its own house. Third, by giving a third party the right to sue under House Bill 468, it creates an additional deterrent to breaking the law. Fourth, all of this is done with little to no cost to the state. A few other little tidbits I'd like to throw in. One of them is the federal government is now working on a bill that is similar to the one that we would like to see, only it is just addressing the federal jobs. This will address all of them. Another item is that the IRS, in 1984, figured they lost $38 million to contractors that are doing this. Another item is the workman's comp in the state of Alaska. It keeps rising, as we all know, and one of the reasons is due to the subcontracting that is going on out there right now. If you have any questions, I will do my best to answer them.
Okay, any questions for this witness? All right.
No.
Representative Taylor?
You just made a statement that I'm trying to understand. You said workers' comp was going up because of subcontractors working out there right now. Could you clarify that for me, please?
Now, I guess this is my opinion of it, but what has happened is when these people are classified as subcontractors, The contractor is not paying workman's comp on him. The man goes out and he gets hurt, and he has no workman's comp. Who picks this up but the state? And when the state, you know, has to run up a bill, workman's comp rates go up because of construction accidents.
Well, that's where I think you're confusing things. The workers' comp rate does not go up because it is not a construction accident. The way you described it, he's a subcontractor, uninsured, violating the law, and instead he gets covered under Medicaid because you said he couldn't afford to pay the damages, so the state picked up the tab. Well, the only way the state would pick up the tab on that fellow would be under Medicaid. That's not going to impact workers' comp or workers' comp rates at all, because workers' comp is a separate insurance contract accounted for differently.
Yeah, you've got OSHA, and we do, as state people or citizens, we pay Medicaid too. I suppose you're actually correct as far as workman's comp going up. What I guess I'm really trying to get at is the state ends up paying this. Now, whether it's workman's comp, OSHA, what, you know, Medicaid, whatever you want, if the person is not insured and he is injured, inevitably the people that are playing the game fair are the ones who are paying for it.
We do have somebody from the Department of Labor signed up, I think, so we might be able to address that question then also. Joan, did you want to run through the bill with the committee?
Uh-huh.
Just identify yourself.
For the record, my name is Joan Knoffel, staff to Representative Donnelly. The legislation really has two main provisions to it. Number one, it provides a person who suffers damages with the right to bring an action if a bidder, a successful bidder, has misclassified an employee, an independent contractor, an employee as an independent contractor, and by doing so has violated either the unemployment contributions, workers' compensation, or Social Security payments under the UFC. A person may not bring that charge if they themselves were in violation of either three of those provisions. Secondly, this bill provides the state with the ability to bring an action as well and delineate some civil penalties they can bring up. From what I understand, the General Services Division within the Department of Administration already has the authority to look into a bid and make sure they're complying with both workers' comp and unemployment compensation. But there's been a major problem that, at least as far as the IRS sees, 38% of businesses out there may be misclassifying employees as independent contractors. Thereby, the number is so great, the administration is basically doesn't have the capacity to go into every situation and make sure they're complying with these statutes. This legislation would provide a private cause of action to those persons who have suffered damages. Persons would include individual workers, labor community, and trade associations.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
But it also, if I may add, has the is a concern that's been addressed at the national level, and contractors are concerned with this as well, and it's been something adopted at least by the associated AGC in other states. The AGC here in Alaska doesn't have a position on the bill, but outside they have.
I think we have somebody.
Right, we have met with the AGC. This is Rice Rock again, by the way. We have met with the AGC, and they do agree with us on this. Henry Springer is the gentleman we met with, and he's in agreement with us on this. This bill has also been put into place in other states, in Connecticut and in Oregon. They have basically the same bill, and like I was saying before, the federal government is now doing it on federal projects. You know, it really comes down to, let's just make it an even playing field so everybody has a shot at the job that is fair.
Okay. We do have somebody from labor who might be able to answer some of our questions about that, so... Who's here from the Labor Department, Randy? Well, why don't you come up and... I think Representative Taylor raised a point that I think he might be able to address better. What happens when somebody's not covered by the workers' comp and injured?
I can try, Mr. Chairman. I'm not,
sure.
Not well versed in workers' comp or UI since I'm with Labor Standards and Safety, but I'll certainly give it a shot.
Okay. You want to just give... You decided to give general testimony on the bill, too.
That may have been an error. I'm actually here with 489.
Okay, so you just really want to answer questions?
Certainly.
Okay, first of all, does the department have a position? The
department has no position on this bill. It doesn't affect the way labor standards and safety or workers' comp operates.
Okay, and we do have a zero fiscal note.
That's correct.
Okay.
Are there any questions for the Department of Labor?
Yeah, I guess I have a couple. It's been alleged here that you guys don't have the time or the resources to find this out. Is that correct?
The workers' compensation, through the chair, the workers' compensation division no longer has an investigative staff to investigate complaints of employers who do not have workers' compensation insurance. So they have lost that ability in which they were exploring those complaints and trying to take action against those employers.
Yes, so what do they do now?
That is beyond my expertise. My understanding is that the board, the comp board, has procedures that they can go through, but I don't know what those are.
Well, there's a series of things that can be done. I mean, there's a violation of state law, for crying out loud. There's all kinds of things that can be done. Attorney General's office can be stuck in order. We're sitting around here talking about how 38% is some number given to us by the IRS. Well, I happen to know that part of that number given to you by the IRS is because cab drivers are historically considered independent contractors all over the United States. They're not employees. They're not paying benefits and workers' comp and the rest of them. Cab drivers. Cab drivers are independent contractors. They lease the cabs. I mean, there's all kinds of folks out there like that. And yes, would the IRS love to have them as employees? You bet they would. Then they got somebody in there paying their Social Security. Social Security right now is a bigger amount of tax being paid on the average employee than income tax is. So yeah, Social Security, they'd love to have that being paid. IRS would be real happy to jump in there and tell you all about others. Probably 38 to 40% of independent contractors. But who are these independent contractors and what impact are they having in particular on the construction trades that we're talking about here? Is this a major problem in Alaska? And if so, who's being injured? And I guess my next question is, who gets to bring the suit? Is it the guy who was the second high bidder, the one that was the third high bidder? Or is it the labor union if this guy's non-union? Or is nobody going to make a stink if he is a union contractor? Then we ain't going to hear from anybody on this one. This piece of legislation's got a real funny smell to it. I want somebody to take the smell away for me so that I can fall in love with it like the rest of you think you are right now.
Okay, are there any more questions for Mr. Carr or Ms. Knopfler? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Teresa Gerald?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Teresa Gerald, and I'm with the National Federation of Independent Business. I distributed to the staff yesterday a position paper.
I think it's in the pack.
Mm-hmm. And some backup information, and essentially what we would like to see is that if you are going to give other people access to contest a bid, is let's tighten up on the definition of independent contractors. I'm very familiar with Representative Taylor's constituent and his problem. The employees do bring complaints that he has had some problems. One section of the Department of Labor says that his taxi cab drivers are not employees, they are independent contractors. And another division side of the Department of Labor says, well, yes, they are, and you have to pay up, and they try to penalize him, and he's hired attorneys, it's gone on and on and on. At a meeting last year with then Commissioner of Labor, Sarah, we took around some different ideas, and one of the ideas was very simplistic, is when a person, if I'm an independent contractor, okay, I have a business license, and to my clients, I provide a copy of my business license. Have these people that consider themselves an independent contractor, make them get a business license. The fear inside of the Department of Labor that was expressed last year was these people, poor people, may not know that they're not being covered by workers' comp and unemployment benefits. Have on the actual application a big bold letters as an independent contractor, a person being in business for yourself, you are responsible for paying your own workers' comp or disability insurance if you choose to get it. You are responsible for yourself, and the person that is contracting with you is not responsible. I do believe that it does need to be tightened up. Oregon tightened it up. The feds, the IRS has 20 common law rules that they use. They've mentioned the IRS. The IRS is, yes, cracking down on independent contractors, but what they are doing is they see it as a revenue enhancer. It's not necessarily that it's being grossly abused anymore today than it was in the past, but there's a lot of national news articles I could provide you that speak to their revenue-enhancing activities. Okay, I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Okay, any questions for this witness? Representative Zawacki, then Representative Taylor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Risa, I see your position paper here, but actually you talk about wanting to change the statute, or the status of independent contractors. You haven't said yes or no that you support the bill as is. If this bill were to move forward as is, without changing the definition at all, what is the position of NFIB?
Well, Representative Zawacki, I get stuck in the precarious position occasionally. Our policy at NFIB is if our members have not voted on an issue, because if our ballot and our annual poll is what sets our legislative agenda, I am not in a position to offer an opinion. But since this is offering an opportunity for somebody else to get involved in the process to say, hey, go check those folks out over there. They're misrepresenting whether somebody's an employee or an independent contractor. It seems like since the opportunity to potentially harass a business person, maybe we ought to tighten up on the definition, which our members have voted up. How's that for being a good politician, tap dancing? And my members haven't voted on it, so I can't say on this specific piece of legislation, other than try to tighten it up since it possibly could cause people some problems.
Representative Taylor.
Well, I was kind of hoping for the same thing, but it seems to me that the issue is, again, one of definition and not so much one of creating a new action of law. Merely by cleaning up the definition of what is or is not a subcontractor, and I too have had discussions with Commissioner Usera and her predecessor, in fact, about this very same concern, because the definition is somewhat vague. But I would still like an answer if someone can tell me who brings the suit, and to what extent is that person damaged? In other words, Zawacki, he underbids me on the job, and he cheats. See, he hires these guys, and he really, well, he has to, because I'm that good. He's going to have to do a bad to get under me. But he hires these guys and doesn't pay their workers' comp and has them down, doesn't pay any unemployment the whole bit. And as a consequence, I feel I've been injured. Now, I was the next highest bidder. But Betty here, she was the next highest bidder above me. And Pat over there was the next highest bidder above her. Are we limited by the amount of our bids in what we can sue? Are we, in other words, let's say he underbid me by $5,000 and I underbid her by $5,000 and so on. To what extent am I really injured? And where? How are my injuries measured? Off of what? My lost quote profit? I'm just having a hard time, David, understanding what the cause of action is, because it's an action for which I wasn't damaged. Mm-hmm.
John, did you want to? Is there any more questions for Ms. Sherman?
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Taylor, I'm afraid I can't give you as clear an answer to that as you would like. I've spoken to legal about that and how actually to define a person who suffers damages. And a major, at least from their point of view, that they felt that should be a determination left to the court. Now, in the scenario you rose, if this is not amended, I presume that Representative Bruckman could bring damages, Representative Zawacki was one of the suits against, correct?
Right.
So Representative Taylor and Representative Parnell. And it would be for the courts to determine the extent of their damages. Now, if Representative Bruckman was the third highest bidder, she perhaps wouldn't have suffered damages. You, as the second highest bidder, would be the person to suffer damages. And I could see a court litigating to state that she wouldn't have received any benefit in the first place. So therefore, while this person may have been abusing the law, she would have no right to cause action you in turn would. But the statute doesn't say that. I'm guessing at how it might be.
That's my concern. The statute doesn't say that, and as a consequence, let's say Pat is the only one who's upset. Betty and I look at it, and we say, no, we'd have done business the same way as Zawacki did. we just didn't get the bid. But we're not going to go out and hire an attorney and bring a suit ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now, does Pat then have to come through each of us before he can get the right to sue? In other words, do we have to assign our rights to him in some sort of priority level? Because if not, aren't we a complete defense for Mr. Zawacki to come to either Betty or I, who underbid Pat, and say to the court, we chose not to sue, we had no damages, and yet we'd have profited greater than he would have because our bids were, you see? Now, I shouldn't say that. We would not have profited better. We'd have had the work quicker than he would have.
I guess.
Is there a subrogation, in other words, has to occur?
Yeah. This doesn't require there be actual damages to bring the suit, and there is a public policy consideration here, too. If there was a violation of the law, that, as a citizen, I think that would sustain the interest in, you know, that might establish their ability as a party. Their
does that mean all three of us could sue him?
I think
the labor union that was upset, too?
I think anybody could sue, but you wouldn't be able to collect damages. You wouldn't have any damages, but you could enforce the law. Your suit would be, from a public policy point of view, from an enforcement of the law.
There was a rebid.
Yeah, you force the process to happen again. If that's what the court...
You wouldn't get a rebid. The job would probably be already done by that.
Yeah.
Well, you'd be entitled to one if it turned out. It may not recover damages.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to bring up something earlier. I guess that's a concern that I have. Maybe we can get it resolved. We were told that AGC was not taking a position earlier, and then is it Ray in Anchorage?
Mr. Rock.
Rock, yeah, in Anchorage said that he talked to Henry and that they had taken a position. I'd like to know if Henry has responded in favor of this in writing. If he hasn't, I would hope that somebody would go back to AGC because they do represent a large destruction continuously throughout this entire state, and I think it would have some very important bearing on this bill if we did have AGC online.
Ms. Knuckles.
I can address that. Through the chair, Representative Zawacki, I was informed of the same, what I was told was support from the AGC. I in turn called the AGC, and their representative was, from what I understood, going to be here today, but he was not. The position was that I was told that they did not, Mr. Ward?
Oh, they
did
have something.
Okay. They did not oppose the bill. They believed that this was an issue that needed to be addressed, and they were uncertain if this was the proper vehicle, means of addressing it. But they, in not having opposition to it, they weren't going to look for any alternative way to address it. This seemed like an approach they could, that may or may not work.
Why don't we see if the gentleman in the audience would like to come forward? If you could just identify yourself, since you didn't sign up, I didn't know you were here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Ward, and I do represent the Associated General Contractors here in Juneau. And I didn't plan to testify. I didn't sign up to testify because the AGC didn't intend to testify on the bill. I chatted with Henry Springer about it. The AGC is not opposed to the bill. They're not. It's not their intent to.
And clarify.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Flanagan?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ed Flanagan with the Alaska District Council of Laborers. I'm also here today representing the state of Alaska AFL-CIO. I'll depart from my prepared testimony since it reiterates much of what was said earlier in favor of the bill, and I'll strap on the task of trying to remove some of the smell for Representative Taylor. We're not talking about cab drivers here, sir, and we're not talking about bona fide subcontractors that go bare in terms of workers' comp, but that is a very large problem, and that problem bleeds over into these so-called independent contractors. When the Department of Labor had a workers' comp investigator back in 88, when this body was considering major workers' comp reform, there was a lot of testimony, particularly out of Fairbanks, about contractors using their out-of-state workers' comp rates, which were much lower for construction crafts. And when that investigator was put on the dime about why weren't, he says, hell, I only had time to catch the ones that were bare completely. They didn't even have time to worry about the ones. If they were paying anything in workers' comp, they let them go. Now, I wasn't even aware until today that there isn't even an investigator for workers' comp. We're talking about flag people being made independent contractors. They show up for work. They're given the employer's flag. They're told where to be, how long to be there, what to do. They exercise none of the functions of an independent contractor. I'm not aware. I know there's the feds are pretty clear on what constitutes an employer-employee relationship, and I believe the state adopts that. I don't know that NFIB has such a big problem in their poll. Only 9% of respondents to Ms. Gerald's poll had a problem with the Department of Labor over the use of independent contractors, and a third of those had it resolved successfully to their benefit or in their favor. We're talking about people that set up these relationships with people that have been considered employees in the construction industry for 100 years, and all of a sudden, I'm not saying there isn't new technology and new structural changes in the industry that result in more specialization, but when the level of specialization gets down to the individual flag person being an independent contractor, somebody's evading the law. And whether you have a proper form for the person to sign away their rights on, I don't think that's the issue either. The people are made a party to the evasion and the unfair competitive advantage that these unscrupulous individuals get from using this process to beat out fair contractors who treat their employees under the law and pay the required contributions for their benefit, which are basic public policy. And I think there wouldn't be a plethora of suits. It's not easy to get people to come forward in these circumstances. But when there is a smoking gun, right now in many cases where the state enforces, and those people are spread thin, they go out and they try not to duplicate efforts. If someone's out, contracting person's out, they'll check the Davis-Bacon and everything else. But if they catch somebody, first offense and even second offense, it's very rarely more than a slap on the wrist, and they pay what they should have been paying in the first place. That's the extent of the punishment. If you look for a little bit off the topic, but if you look at Davis-Bacon, where there's a clear mechanism for debarment, we don't debar but a couple of contractors a year in an industry that's rife with cheating. And anything that this doesn't put a burden on the state, I think your normal provisions against frivolous lawsuits should help deter those, if that is at all going to be an issue. The difficulty of getting the testimony, but at least here there's something that can be done other than this minor deterrent floating out there in the existing state law. Someone knows that the person that he or she cheated out of the job, has some action to come after them now.
Okay. Any questions for the witness? Yeah. Taylor?
Why does this show up? Where's this been for the last 8 years, under 8 years of Democratic governors with Democratic departments of labor?
Mr. Flanagan?
I'm not going to entirely respond, but I think this practice has become much more widespread over the past 8 years, and even more recently in the last 3 or 4 years, sir. So that may be part of the answer.
I see Mr. Carr shaking his head back there, agreeing with that. Representative Brooklyn.
He said there was an employee that's no longer in the department that would oversee this.
Mr. Carr referred to that, but I was not aware there was no longer. There was one person in the workers' comp division that was basically doing compliance audits to make sure that employers were A, covered, and B, covered at the proper rates, and that one fell by the wayside real quick. It was just whether they were covered at all. And you could pay on an iron worker where the costs are astronomical because of the number of injuries, mm-hmm. pay a laborer rate, which is a half to a third, you know, those kind of cheating. I assume that's going on even a lot more now since there's nobody watching.
Thank you. I would like to look into that. Thank you.
Sure. I remember when we worked on the workers' comp legislation, there was a lot of testimony about the problem that people using outside comp insurance was creating to the Alaska rates. Mm-hmm. It was a really unfair advantage and hurt the contractors that followed the law. Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions for this witness? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Today. That's all the folks I have up to testify. We do have Mr. Rasmussen from Department of Transportation here if the committee had any questions. There are no questions. The general discussion, Mr. Wilson.
I have a question.
Okay, Representative Taylor.
How is this any different than, 29 that just oozed out of resources the other day? Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if she's familiar with 29.
I am, but okay. HB 29 is the right of the citizens to bring a suit for environmental damages. Is that
right?
I think that's this is very much different. Looking at the language of the legislation, I do believe you have to be a person who suffers damages in order to bring a case.
No, you don't.
If a person suffers damages as a result of a competitive bid,
you said person
the person may bring an action.
As a labor union, it is defined as all kinds of people.
And how is...
I think she's right now as well earlier, yeah.
Okay. I believe that's what the language is. I think it's a lot easier under this legislation to determine what a monetary damage would be as compared to a damage one may suffer under HB 29. And I believe this is a much clearer vehicle as to who actually may bring the suit.
I guess what I'm getting at, Mr. Chairman, is it seems to me that we have state agencies and entities set up through the executive branch to do certain functions. And one of those powers that we give to the executive branch is that of sovereign immunity. They're immune to make certain decisions. And the decisions sometimes have to be made of a discretionary nature that are not subject to litigation. When it comes to people being raped and murdered and pillaged on the streets, we give that authority to a district attorney, who on behalf of the king brings charges, criminal charges, against people who do bad acts. But even that district attorney has the right of nulla prosequi. He can choose who he wishes to sue or not sue. And if you'll remember, a few years back, I fought like hell on the floor to prevent us from taking the citizens' right to bring that suit on their own, remember, away from them. And we did. We stole it back away from the people. Human beings can no longer bring that kind of a suit. Only district attorneys can.
Well, a grand jury can, until...
That's the way a district attorney brings it anyhow. He's the only one who gets to talk to a grand jury. You and I don't get to call one for the fun of it. My concern here is that I see this bill and 29 as both coming from the same basis, and that is either a lack of faith in the executive and some sort of vigilante sort of activity that... system isn't working, so we'll solve the way the system isn't working by allowing every frustrated bidder in the marketplace or every frustrated labor union to dash off and sue whoever they wish to sue. And I don't think that's healthy public policy. The appropriate thing to do is run it through your Department of Labor as you always have. And it seems strange to me that the people have been very satisfied to run it through that Department of Labor for the last 8 years. Now all of a sudden we're not. Now all of a sudden I'm seeing this kind of legislation come up. For the last 8 years, all the greenies were very satisfied with DEC. Now along comes 29, and everybody wants to go out and be able to bring their own environmental action in the name of the state. I think that's bad public policy.
Any further discussion? I don't have anybody else to sign. Representative Brett.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly. I found Representative Taylor's comments interesting. I thought they were somewhat contradictory, though. And this legislation is a help towards labor. It's providing protection of employees who aren't and shouldn't be independent contractors. And I have to state that I am an independent contractor with a real estate license, if you wish to find that a conflict. You know, please do so, but it is in the real estate industry, not in the construction industry. I support this bill, and I think it gives another avenue for recourse for an injured party to go to court and have it resolved there. I find it dismaying that the state isn't overseeing these kinds of things any longer, or to the best ability that it should be, and that some protections need to be made. I don't see a fiscal note. I'm assuming it's a zero.
There's a zero from Department of Labor.
Is there
an intention? Yeah, there's a zero from Department of Labor.
You're right, here it is, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Which even makes it more enticing to pass out of this committee on to the next committee of referral. But I would like to see it on the House floor as soon as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is that a motion?
You could take it as a motion.
If you do take this as an objection.
Well, that's okay. No, the motion just is... But sets it up for discussion.
If yes.
Okay. There are motions before us. There's an objection, discussion. Representative Zwack.
I guess maybe I have a question. Maybe I should have asked the Department of Labor. Let's, and maybe I'm totally wrong on my thinking here, but let's take the assumption that this contract was awarded. The work was done. Then the lawsuit applies. Then I am the disgruntled against Robin Taylor now.
Mm-hmm.
He reversed the trick on his contract. And so is Betty, and so is Pat Parnell. And we decide a year later to sue. can we not go back to, if it's a government contract that was let out, state contract, can we not turn around and sue the state for not guaranteeing that this was indeed a contractor who had a legal independent contractor out there? Because we may talk about a fiscal note being zero here, but the fact is, I can turn around and not only sue him, but I can go and sue the state for not making sure that you indeed had this contractor, an independent contractor, comply with
it. But it says that in paragraph A, line 10, it says that the action that's allowed is an action against the person who was awarded the contract.
Well, okay, but my question is, the state awarded the contract, went out to the bidding process, they awarded the contract out there. Three other people are unsatisfied a year later, decide to sue. Can that they turn back and also sue the state because the state wasn't vigilant in regards to knowing that this individual was in compliance? See what I'm trying to
say? Sure, but my thinking here, and Representative Taylor maybe help me out on this, is I don't think this would change any status quo of that. There are liabilities of the state for failing to exercise its proper role. Those are limited. The legislature regulates those. I don't think this would impact that one way or the other, because this extends this right of action as being against the person who was awarded the contract. Now, that may or may not exist now, but this wouldn't change that.
It doesn't
matter.
Yeah.
His
question. Yeah. I think, Mr. Chairman, you're correct on that. My difficulty, though, is I return to the same question I'd asked Ms. Knuckles earlier, and that is, what is the amount of damages? How do you measure damages? A person suffers damage, losing a bid, may bring a cause of action for damages, he says.
Yeah, I think that's, it'd probably be, you and I know that it'd eventually be decided by a court, whatever the damages.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at is, the damages have to have some relationship to the bid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we obviously lost the bid because the guy underbid you. So you left $5,000 on the table. You're too high. The damage is what? I mean, he saved you. You'd have spent $5,000 more doing the job.
Well, I think what you'd see, and I'm guessing, right, is that the first you'd have to establish yourself as being your standing as a plaintiff, right?
Yeah.
And you would go to the court and have to make some showing of damage. And it'd be up to the court to determine whether that was an adequate showing or not to give you the standing to proceed with your suit. I mean, in your complaint, you would state what your standing was. You would state what your assertion of damages was.
You'd have to show you suffered damage.
Yeah, exactly.
You're showing a suffering damage would be that you didn't get the bid.
That probably could be it if you intended to make a profit off the bid, yeah.
Well, I hope.
Or maybe there was another reason you wanted the bid, too. I don't know.
You see, that's where I have the problem. I don't understand how you are damaged by not getting the bid because Jim underbid you and fails to comply with the law.
Well, your loss of profit you would have made if you obtained the bid, and sure, it's your loss of profit.
All right. But
not to mention, I can think of consequential damages. Let's say that was the only bid in that particular type of work that year because the other person didn't comply with the law and underbid you based on that. Then you lost your ongoing operation, and somehow you fell out of the industry,
right,
and couldn't maintain. I can think of a bunch of damages you could plead, in your
well,
complaint.
They got to be foreseeable.
Yeah.
Somehow the person awarding it has to be.
Sure, it'd be subject to all the normal rules.
Right.
But, I mean, you could certainly, I can think of several different levels of damages there you just served.
I don't know. It just seems to me to be a bizarre situation. I just can't for the life of me understand how, because normally there are, it's like 3, 4, 5 people bidding on a job. One of them gets it. He chooses during the job maybe to take care of his sheet rockers. He brings in a subcontractor. Happens to be his brother-in-law who's always worked with him or something.
the disgruntled guy decides, oh, that looks like a phony deal to me. I think he's in violation. I'll bring suit. And he could bring suit as long as it's within the statutory period, a significant period of time later. Now, I should have got the damage, or I should have got the bid. Well, if it's the typical situation where there's three or four of us, shouldn't the first person to have the right to bid be the one who was closest? Don't you have to make a kind of a bid determination as to who would then have rights against the successful bidder? And wouldn't the person who is the furthest out have to come through the others who are closest first? Either buy them off or do something to get their rights?
I don't think. It's been a long time since I studied the transfer of rights in law school, but I don't think there'd be a pretty strong public policy preclusion, don't you think, to selling your rights to sue on that issue?
Oh, the insurance companies do it all the time, call subrogation.
Yeah, but that's based on insurance coverage, right?
No, it's like anything else. You got a right to subrogate your claim.
This would be an insurance policy in a sense.
Yeah.
So what would be, let's say that you could subrogate your claim. What's wrong with that if it serves a public policy purpose?
I'm not saying that, I'm not really opposing the legislation. I'm just saying I'm trying to understand how technically the thing could possibly work, mm-hmm. whether it's two or three or four bidders. Mm-hmm. Does Pat Parnell, who bid $10,000 higher,
right.
Betty Bruckman, who bid $7,000 higher, Robin Taylor, who bid $5,000 higher, Ivan, who bid $4,000 higher. I mean, do we have to go in that descending order so that Ivan is the only one who can sue Jimmy, who got the bid? Or does Ivan have to sign off before I get the chance to sue, and I have to sign off, and so does Ivan before Betty can sue, and the three of us have to sign off before Pat can sue, because we were damaged first?
I understand your question, and it's probably something we could deal with in judiciary. I mean, I don't know. I think the court's going to make the decision on whether somebody fits under the definition of suffers damages. The court's going to do that. Now, we can legislatively attempt to narrow this down.
We ought to at least define who the victim is supposed to be around here.
Well,
excuse me, Representative Donnelly.
Okay, Mr. Rock.
Is there a possibility that I could get on the teleconference? I was supposed to be at 2 o'clock, and I'm a little late, unless you have more questions for me.
You can go if you want. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, and I hope you look into the bill. Thank you.
Representative Brooke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the victim and the victims in this cases have been all along the workers who are made to perform as an employee, told when to go to lunch, when to come back to lunch, what time to show up to work, what to wear to work, and all the other things. When a contractor puts in a bid using independent contractors, or wins the bid, the reason they have a low bid is because they're paying less. They're not paying the compensations, the insurances, the benefits to the employees. That's been the victim. I think it's the workers all along who have been the victim that don't have the jobs. And I'm not an attorney. I'll leave it between the attorneys to argue and define who has the right in court to sue. The outcome is that the victims are protected. We've cleaned up something that there's been a problem with, and if these percentages, 38%, are any indication of how many folks are getting away with this and the harm that's resulted, my duty here, in my opinion, is to pass this out of here and protect the future employees. And I would leave it up to the attorneys and the court systems to argue who has the right to sue in court.
Well, I guess we're down to the question of whether we want to narrow down
suffers
damages, or whether we want to leave it up to the court to make
Betty
that
raised,
determination.
Betty raised the real nut in the whole bill, and that is, who is the victim?
Mm-hmm.
And the victim is, quote, unquote, the employee who did not get the proper type of coverage that they should have had, right? We all agree on that,
mm-hmm.
right? How is this employee in any way benefited by this bill? They're not.
They get a job.
No, they don't.
I think
a guy who lost a bid gets a suit to sue a contractor. The guy who did the brickwork and the guy who did the door work and the framing work and put in the plumbing, he don't get squat. He's out of this thing.
I think I know an answer to your inquiry here, and that's the way you get a benefit
is from a deterrent factor from these type of people illegally, you know, conducting this activity in the future. Mm-hmm. If there's a deterrent to them, then the benefit is that in the future they will obey the law and provide the required coverage for the workers.
Yeah, but it isn't just being robbed. What I'm getting at is this is the person damaged here is not the one bringing the suit. If it was the person who was really damaged that was the one bringing the suit, you and I wouldn't have any discussion going on right now about how do we define this victim. How do we define this guy who lost a bid and now wants to bring a suit against the guy who won a bid? We wouldn't have to worry about that. Because it'd be the victim who would be having the right to do this. The employee. But you see, the employee is a fellow conspirator.
Well, there's another.
He gets paid more money. A lot more money, Betty, if he doesn't have to have a whole bunch of deductions taken out of his paycheck. Why do you think the employee does it? He doesn't do it because he gets duped into it all the time, and he doesn't do it because the evil employer beats him over the head and says, you have to do this as an independent contractor or I won't let you come to work. He does it because the employee makes a lot more money that way. He gets paid the money instead of it going to the workers' comp benefit, instead of it going to somebody else.
The employee is single without children and a family.
Some of them do and some of them don't get paid that.
That's right. Now, what do you do with the one who becomes the fellow conspirator?
So we've got the motion to move the bill with individual recommendations before us. And there's continued objection?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are we ready for a vote? All right. All those in favor of the motion?
Mr. Chairman, because I believe this is more of a judiciary committee discussion, and it might be one that you might want to come join the group on during that time. Because all of these are issues, this was deja vu for me sitting in judiciary committee.
Yeah.
Rather than labor and commerce, at least at one juncture that the representative.
Okay.
I think that's the place for this discussion.
Okay. So is that a yes vote? Okay. And those opposed to moving the bill this time? One. And abstaining? Okay. So with that, this bill was moved from committee. And on the agenda, House Bill 489, safety requirements for boilers.
It takes four votes to move out
here. We have four. Five.
Yeah, three.
No, it just takes a...
One, two, three.
It just takes a majority of the quorum.
No, it takes a majority of the committee, not of the quorum. If that was the case, all you'd ever need to have four people here, you'd have to have it be three of them.
We argued this before in this committee.
It's the same rules throughout all committees.
I know,
it's not just this committee.
But it wasn't that long ago. I thought it was clearly convincingly argued.
If you want to move a bill out, you need a majority of a committee. That's why you've got a majority on each committee, so you can do something.
I've just never had that problem before. Okay.
Jerry Mackey had it happen to him in his own committee the other day on his own bill.
Well, we'll just hold on to it then for now. It's still with us. We needed one more vote.
Yeah. Do you want me to go ahead? Should we go sign it now or wait?
He had two more committee hearings before he could get his own bill after his own committee.
Pardon?
Should I sign it now or wait?
You can't
well,
sign it yet.
I'm going to... Representative. Well, basically what I think what's happened here is Representative Taylor's raised a procedural objection, a point of order.
No, I haven't. It's a matter of your own rules.
No, it's not.
Well, yeah, you've raised a rule, a point of order, that the bill can't move from committee without four votes. And
sure.
And I'm going to take that point of order under advisement because I'd like to find out, you know, what the answer is. So I don't think the bill should move until we've got a definitive answer to Representative Taylor's point of order.
And I would argue that this already talked. We've already made that decision in this committee earlier this session, and that the majority of those...
Well, if that's the case, I guarantee you won't have this kid making your quorums for you anymore, Dan. You're going to start violating the rules. That won't work. Yes, well, hun, I've been here 8 years. We ain't changed those rules in all those eight.
Bet you a dollar.
I'll put a lot more money on this. It's worth a lot more than that to me.
Representative Taylor, if you all leave and Representative Ivan comes back, don't think the bill won't move. Because we got this, you know, we're going to...
That's what the committee process is for, Dan.
Okay.
I have no problem with that. I live by those rules.
All right. Okay. I think I'd like to read it before I ruled on it as chair.
No, I sympathize with the chair.
I do think that you're right.
Oh, I know.
But I wanted to, I'd like to check with legal, and I'd like to check with the rules committee before we did something just to save us the hassle of coming back and doing it again. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll just wait to sign it.
Right. So, In fact, if Labor and Commerce staff has a memorandum or anything from the Rules Committee on that subject, I could...
Okay, good.
So we'll take up 489. We can still continue. We can't take any action without recording, but Representative Ivan gave me a note that he was coming back. Mr. Carr, were you here on 429?
Yes.
Or 489? Is there anybody else here on 489? Because nobody signed up here or anything else. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Carr. I'm the Acting Director of the Labor Standards and Safety Division. The department supports 489 bill setting forth adoption of codes for boilers and elevators and making some amendments to the current boiler bills regarding inspections of new installations. I've had some discussions with some of the committee members, and I'm available for any questions that they may have.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at it. So we've got a new requirement that you notify the department if you're going to install a boiler or unfired pressure vessel?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And does that include, like, in any, like, a private dwelling? Let's say I built my own house and I was going to put a, you know, a... Would that be a boiler, like a hot water heater? Is that classified as a
technically
boiler?
Technically, it is a boiler, but we don't have jurisdiction in private residences.
Okay, so this is only for, like, commercial?
Commercial.
Does it extend to large housing units also?
Yes, it does.
Over four.
So what's the cutoff there? That was my next question, too. What's the cutoff there? Fourplexes?
I think it is a fourplex.
Okay, so what we got here is if somebody builds a fourplex, from now on they're going to be required to notify the department that they're putting in their boiler there.
That's correct.
Okay. Does Representative Sharpe?
Are we on?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, you're notified that the installation is about to occur, but that at that point you're no longer involved, is the way I read this.
No, through the chair, Representative Brooklyn. Presently, the statute requires that the department conduct an inspection of a new installation before it can even go online. We have no means of knowing now because there's no requirement to notify us of an installation.
Thank you.
This will give us that notification and will allow us to schedule an inspection, and they can put it online and we can schedule for inspection as early as possible.
Thank you. I misread it, and I thought, why do you want to be notified if you're not going to inspect?
I believe Section 1 repeals the current language.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, the elevator is adoption of some elevator standards I find most pertinent since I agree to that particular problem.
Yeah, it's interesting from my experience on this committee before, I learned that Anchorage is the only municipality that enforces its own elevator code.
That's correct.
Yeah. Everywhere else is under the state code.
Interesting.
Representative Parnett?
Mr. Chairman, did you and I talked and you mentioned there were quite a few that had not been inspected in the past. Did they all get a chance to come online, and are they still to be inspected?
We're presently running approximately 5,000 boilers behind.
So they're all
5,000?
They're all functional then.
We believe they're functional. In many cases, we won't know until we get out to inspect. That's boilers and pressure vessels, many of which in industrial use may be taken offline, and we wouldn't know about it until a regular scheduled inspection is made. There are 22,000 boilers in the state, and with our timetable of inspections, I believe the current number is pretty close to 5,000.
Those are the ones that you have been notified of and that you're aware of?
Those are the ones that we already have knowledge of existing that have been scheduled for. That is one of the problems with the existing language. When it requires that we do an inspection before an installation can be put online, we can't possibly meet that time schedule with the current inspection staff.
If you were to do that with a user fee, so to speak, would that help defray that and change the status so that you could hire more people to
There is currently an inspection fee for these boilers.
But it doesn't cover the cost of keeping staff people online and ready.
It doesn't cover sufficient staff. And we have five inspectors now. We added a new inspector this last year, and it's our hope, with the aid of this bill, that will allow us to get notification of new boilers. We can more effectively schedule our inspection staff so that when they go to a remote area, we know of everything that's in that area, and we can inspect it in one trip and make our inspections more effective. And we're hoping that within 3 to 4 years, we can clear up the backlog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, with the timeline being so important, I'd move this out of committee immediately.
All right. Well, we don't have a quorum anymore.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, I kind of remember we went through this a few years ago. We came to the conclusion, so as you got votes from that. But we'll wait and see what we find out from Rose. Is there any more questions by the committee? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carr. Sorry we can't take action right now, but when Representative Ivan returns, I think this...
Actually, I believe he could have missed the objection.
We don't have a quorum. We need at least four to take action. We've got one more bill on the agenda. We can bring ourselves up to speed on the month. 348? Okay. Apparently we looked at this one before.
Mr. Chairman, would you mind if you asked another person?
Please stay, because Representative Ivan left me a note that he was coming back, and he should be back now. In fact, it's been the time. And we could move a couple of three bills here.
Okay.
I'm sure Representative Finkelstein would
appreciate it. I want the constituents waiting for me now.
Maybe we could go check with Representative Ivan.
Okay.
Or call him.
All right.
Ask him.
348.
Now, Representative Parnell, you had a concern about this bill last meeting, and you asked him that the take a look at information on what other states do, and the department sent the members response that should be included in the file there, memorandum. I guess this is from Virginia Regal. You have asked for the department administration has authority to provide health coverage. I don't know if that's it or not.
I don't know. Sure. Let's see. It may be the other one that we were talking about going to. I got a reply from Commissioner Sarah, but I don't recall that we have one from Virginia.
No.
So you...
Could I ask a question? Were you trying to answer a question?
Sure.
On H, according to the Department of Administration's sectional analysis, they keep talking about HMOs. Would this bill in any way allow HMOs to incorporate, or are they already allowed to? I personally am opposed to that kind of...
There's a gentleman in the audience standing up, although he's not on the list here. Maybe you could identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gary Bader. I'm with the Department of Administration, Director of Retirement Benefits. HMOs are presently allowed under the statute, and this would not change that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I've got a question.
There's a question from Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary, on reflection on what the state would take over and what they would not, is there in the industry, is there any awareness or is there common knowledge on the government entity taking over what would be considered more the high-cost, high-risk features of current insurance coverage? And then continuing to be insured with those other areas that the insurance companies might very well like to have.
That would be possible, and I should reiterate what Commissioner Ysera said, we have no present plans to implement self-insurance. This is enabling legislation.
I understand. I'm just asking ahead of time what the trend is and what figures we might have that show that the high-loss, high-risk sections are gravitating toward government self-insurance policies and then the rest stay with the industry.
Well, what the trend is generally is to go to self-insurance
for the
whole package, or at least we don't have any information that indicates that they parse it out. You might stay with a dental plan insured, and you might have your medical plan and go self-insured, but the trend overall for medical is to go into self-insurance.
You know what happens on the administration of that particular policy, and once it leaves the hands of the private insurer, they're still offered to administer the program?
The trend is still to have insurance companies or third-party administrators, as we call them. The trend is also increasing to have them take care of paying the benefits, interacting with clients, and so on. Self-insurance is essentially a funding mechanism, and the employer could pay claims himself, but typically I think one would first look at having an insurance company do that for them.
Okay, so then the next question that comes to mind, what happens then on the dollar amount that a present firm might be in the black on in the industry in contrast to the cost or not even the cost, but the money that that industry would make or that firm would make as an administrator. Like if they're making 16% on their return right now, as an administrator, would they be making 20? Or where are those figures, and do we have anything like that that's available?
No, we don't have those figures. I don't think that insurance companies generally make them available what their margins are on the various aspects of the business.
On the material that Commissioner Ucero sent over to me, there was a slowing down, so to speak. Like there was a 19% that was used in contrast to the cost of rising insurance was, I think, 24 or 26 in the industry in contrast to self-insurance. It's not a big spread, 5% or 6%. And factored into that, do you include the administrative cost in your cost of insuring? Like, would a 10 or 15% fee for administering it be part of that 19%? Or would that come in above and beyond the 19%? I'm just using that because that was a figure that was in the material.
Sure. My feeling is that the 19, if I remember the question correctly, that the 19% was the rate of increased claims against the plan.
Okay.
And all other things, I presume, would be equal, that they did not measure insurance company growth, including third-party administration, and then compare it with
if and when this passes, and I would somehow like the record to reflect that when the administration enters into negotiations and they feel that this is a thrust they would like to pursue, I would like somewhere, somehow, for those people who are, as they say these days, crunching the numbers, to include all those costs of administering in contrast to present-day insurance coverage, so that we're just not looking at the claim picture, but we're looking at the total picture. And if it costs less to administer it as a self-insured group with deep pockets in contrast to a present company running it with their own deep pockets, with their own investments that have gone bad because of real estate that has gone sour over the years, all those things factored in, I would like the administration to consider all that before it offers up a self-insurance program, so that they have an opportunity to say, yes, we're going to save money, and here's how, and this is a tangible way to do it. Now, I don't know how you filter all that into the process, but maybe I'll just mention a couple more times over the next year or so.
I can assure you that would be filtered into the process. I'm certain that we wouldn't embark on this if we didn't think the cost to the state overall would be reduced, including third-party administration and investment risk.
Well, it's great for us to crow about how much we're saving because of the claims made here in contrast over there, but if it costs us more to run it here than it does over there, then
right.
It's not only not a wash, it's balanced the other way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So you feel okay about moving this building?
Yeah, I'm queasy, but I'll vote.
Okay. I'll state for the record that we do have a quorum now. Representative Breckman, Representative Ivan, Representative Parnell, and myself, Representative Donnelly, are present.
Move the agenda.
Yeah.
I
take that as a motion to move House Bill 348 with individual recommendations from committee. And is there any objection? Hearing no objection, for 348 moves from committee with individual recommendations.
Okay.
At this time, I'd like to entertain a motion to move House Bill 489.
So moved.
Okay, there's a motion to move House Bill 489 with individual recommendations from committee. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, House Bill 489 moves. At this time, I'd like to bring up House Bill 468. Representative Breckman, did you want to make a motion on this bill?
468, yes, sir. I move individual recommendations to
And any objection to the motion to move an individual recommendation? Hearing no objection, motion carries. At this time, I'd like to rule on Representative Taylor's point of order. I find his point of order to be moot, although possibly correct. And with that, we'll adjourn the meeting.